From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. The Senate Judiciary Committee is meeting for the first day of confirmation hearings on the nomination of Judge Amy Coney Barrett to the Supreme Court. President Trump nominated Barrett to the bench late last month following the death of longtime liberal Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, launching what is expected to be one of the quickest and most bitter confirmation fights in Supreme Court history. Let's bring in NPR Justice correspondent Carrie Johnson for more. Hi, Carrie.
Hi there.
So committee chair Senator Lindsey Graham opened the hearings this morning by defending Republicans' rush to confirm Barrett just 22 days before the presidential election. Here's Senator Graham.
The bottom line is Justice Ginsburg, when asked about this several years ago, said that a president serves for 4 years, not three. There's nothing unconstitutional about this process.
Gary, this is the first time hearings have begun in the middle of early voting for the next president. Give us an overview of what's happening today.
What we're hearing today, Tanya, is opening statements from each of the lawmakers, and the day is going to conclude with the introductions of the nominee, Amy Coney Barrett, by two senators from Indiana, former president or leader of the Notre Dame Law School, and then Judge Barrett herself will talk. So far, though, we've been in a bit of a tug of war between Republicans who insist it's the president's constitutional prerogative to appoint a justice this late in the presidential election year, and Democrats who are decrying this rush to judgment, as they say, as the nation is gripped by the COVID pandemic.
Mm-hmm. Democrats have tried to paint Judge Barrett as an enemy of the Affordable Care Act. Here's Senator Dianne Feinstein, ranking member of the Judiciary Committee.
Judge Barrett, you've been critical of Chief Justice Roberts for his 5-4 opinion upholding the law, stating that Roberts, quote, pushed the Affordable Care Act beyond its plausible meaning to save the statute, end quote. This well could mean that if Judge Barrett is confirmed, Americans stand to lose the benefits that the ACA provides.
You alluded to this, but Carrie, how did Democrats present their case today?
Tanya, early and often, virtually every Democratic lawmaker included as part of their opening remarks an image of one of their constituents, a big photo on a poster board talking about men, women, and children who needed health care for some reason or other and whose health care, they say, would be at risk if Judge Barrett gets confirmed on the Supreme Court. You know, the Supreme Court is scheduled to hear just a week after the election yet another challenge to the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. And because Amy Barrett has written some derogatory things in the past about different legal challenges and reasoning by Chief Justice John Roberts, Democrats are arguing that could mean the heart of the law is at risk.
In her opening statement, which was obtained by NPR, Judge Barrett writes that, quote, policy decisions and value judgments of government must be made by the political branches elected by and accountable to the people. The public should not expect courts to do so, and courts should not try. With the little bit of time I have left with you, how does this contradict with what President Trump has said in nominating Barrett to the court?
Well, a couple of things. One is that he, during the campaign and later, said that he would appoint justices to the court who would overturn the landmark abortion rights precedent, Roe v. Wade. And a second thing is that President Trump has said repeatedly that he's committed to overturning or getting rid of the Affordable Care Act, that Obamacare law. That has complicated matters or will complicate matters for Amy Coney Barrett and her confirmation, especially as lawmakers begin to start questioning her, in-depth questioning, Tuesday and Wednesday of this week.
Okay. And how long are they? And what's next?
What's next is that we're going to have extended questions and answers. And then day 4, Thursday, will be lots of witnesses for and against the nominee, Judge Barrett.
That's NPR Justice correspondent Carrie Johnson. As always, thank you.
My pleasure.
11 days after he announced he tested positive for the coronavirus, President Trump is leaving the White House today for a campaign rally in Florida. Across the Sun Belt, his advantage with women, seniors, and suburban voters is eroding, and Democrats like Damian Preciado see an opportunity. Preciado is a vice chair of Arizona's Democratic Party who says Biden is poised to pick up independents and moderate Republicans in this traditionally right-of-center state.
Has Trump taken such an extreme position that anyone center-right finds themselves left of center by 0.1 degrees, 100%. And his behavior has shifted that margin. And he has no one to blame but himself.
If the polls are right in Arizona, Biden could be the first Democrat to win the state since 1996. Of course, the race is far from over, and many Trump voters are far from right of center. They're staunch conservatives who can't be swayed by incendiary statements or chaotic debate performances. These are the voters who helped lift the president to victory 4 years ago, and they're still here in 2020.
Hi, my name is Karen, and my last name is Smith.
I met Karen Smith in a suburb outside of Phoenix. She was waiting in a line of Trump supporters outside a local business where Vice President Mike Pence was about to hold a campaign rally.
Right now I'm in the shade, so that tells you a little bit about it.
Despite the 100-degree heat, Smith wore a neck gaiter that covered her nose and mouth. She says she takes the coronavirus seriously, but the president's handling of the pandemic doesn't concern her.
It doesn't.
It doesn't, even though the virus has killed 215,000 Americans, infected the president, and infiltrated the White House just weeks before the election.
Because we had a friend who recently got sick, who was also elderly, in the same age range as Trump, wore masks everywhere, kept his distance, like you and I are sitting way too close. I socially distance myself.
I can step back if you'd like.
Sure, if you want. I know you're trying to do an interview, but I am upwind from you. So those are things that I practice, is socially distancing. And I think Trump has done that. I've been to one of his rallies. They did temperature checks. A lot of us wore masks. And then when we were there, people are like, oh, they're not socially distanced. But as you got away from the stage, people actually socially distanced themselves.
It's interesting. The polls are showing Donald Trump behind Joe Biden. Interesting in a state like this, traditionally conservative. Do you think that'll hold up? Are you concerned that he might lose this state?
Yeah, but you know, you look back at the campaign against Hillary Clinton, and the polls were very much in favor of her. So when pollsters call me, I usually say I'm voting for the opposite. I'm not very honest in the polls. I don't know why. It's just I don't take polls very seriously. I do like data, but people can change their mind, and not everybody's going to be honest about who they're voting for.
But at this event, most people are pretty clear about it.
Hi, sir. I'm with NPR. Can I ask you some questions?
Sure.
So, first of all, can you introduce yourself for me?
Juan Baldonado.
Baldonado is a nuclear power worker wearing a Trump hat and a neon green shirt with the candidates' names emblazoned across it.
You know, I'm a far-right conservative. I don't believe in abortion, late-term abortion. It's just the far left has gone too left.
Now, I see your shirt. It says Latinos for Trump. We're in Arizona, a state where Latinos could help Joe Biden win the state. How do you feel about that?
I don't think so. I think a lot of Latinos are waking up, like the African-American community is waking up. They're tired of being misled and lied to and treated as pawns by the Democratic Party. Nobody really wants the EBT card and the Section 8 and all that. No, you want to pull your bootstraps up and work for yourself. The Republican Party will help you do that.
But what would explain the fact that Joe Biden is looking pretty good in Arizona right now?
I don't think he's looking pretty good at all. I think...
I'm referring to the polls, you know.
Yeah, well, I don't... The polls are fake, too, you know. We'll just see what happens November 3rd.
If you're sensing a theme here, few people at this rally trust the polls, including Sylvia Reyes a little further down the line.
Sylvia Reyes, and you have a Trump 2020 mask on and a Women for Trump flag on
That's
your purse
right.
there. So I guess I know who you're voting for.
Exactly, sir.
Why so?
Because he's doing great for America and for Hispanics, Blacks, and everybody else, blue, green, and purple.
Tell me more about that.
And I love him, and he's going to do great, and we're going to win again. And nothing they say about Trump will change my mind.
So let me ask you, are you better off today than you were 4 years ago?
Yeah.
Yes, I am.
Yes.
Yes, definitely.
Yes.
You
no
say yes
too,
ma'am.
Yes.
What's your name?
Yes, Susan. Susan Thomas.
And why do you say yes?
Because my 401k is still better off than it was during all the Obama years.
That's right. Mine too.
So your 401k, your personal situation is better. Do you think the country is in a better situation?
Yes, absolutely. He changed everything. I knew on the day he was elected, and I didn't expect he was going to be elected, I was there changing all my investments. And I don't have that much money. I'm a middle-class manager, you know, for all my life. I never made much more than $50,000 a year. But I changed everything that day because I knew that pent-up demand was there. It was waiting for somebody. And if Biden's elected, it's going down the tubes.
What about the divisions in this country, though? Do you not blame him?
Who is doing the dividing?
You tell me.
I think it's the Democrats.
Starting with Obama.
Starting with Obama. Yes, absolutely.
Thomas later told me she's training to be a poll watcher on Election Day, one of 50,000 volunteers the Trump campaign is recruiting across the country to stand guard against voter fraud that election experts say just doesn't happen on a meaningful scale.
I'm willing to do anything for this man. I really am. And I haven't felt that way, even for Ronald Reagan.
Those experts say Trump's poll watchers could lead to voter intimidation or violence. So what does Susan Thomas think would solve the ever-deepening division in this country?
I think it's going to take a total upheaval of faith and people to come to realize that these freedoms are God-given. And yes, we are foot soldiers. We'll stand here, but we believe that the battle is won.
Amen.
It's God's battle. But it's my job to be faithful and be out here, and I will.
A few Trump voters outside of Phoenix. In the coming days, we'll hear from Democrats who think they have a shot at winning Arizona.
NPR listeners might remember hearing author Lon Cao a few years ago being interviewed by her daughter Harlan as part of a StoryCorps project. Lon came to the U.S. as a refugee from Vietnam in 1975. She was 13 years old and didn't speak English.
My parents told me that I'm just going on a short trip with Papa Fritz. He's sort of like a second dad for me. And he was going to take me to Connecticut to be with his family for maybe a few weeks.
But it wasn't just a few weeks. Lon's parents eventually joined her in the United States. She excelled at school, became a lawyer, and then a law professor and novelist. She and her husband, Bill Van Alstyne, had Harlan in 2002. He died in 2019. His death was only one of many challenges the pair faced. As a Vietnamese refugee, Lon had to deal with racism as well as memories of the Vietnam War and her own feelings of displacement. Harlan grew up in the shadow of her mother's trauma and became the subject of bullying in high school. The two tell their stories in the new book, Family in Six Tones. And Lon Cao joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Tanya.
And Harlan Van Cao also joins us. She's a student at UCLA. Welcome to you as well.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Lon, we heard just a bit of your story. What do you remember most about that time?
I remember coming here and being extremely shocked by the realization that I'm going to be here permanently. So even the smallest thing, like not seeing a tamarind tree outside my window, but a pine tree instead because we moved to New England, was shocking to me. So the small things can sometimes be as jolting as something that seemingly is more momentous.
Harlan, you write, when I was four, I began to see the demons that lived in her, referring to your mother, PTSD demons, shadow selves. Your mother would have what you describe as fits, almost become another person. That must have been terrifying for you to witness as a child without the language or understanding of what she was going through.
Yes, and I mean, obviously it's a lot like pouring a bucket of ice onto my head and like just expecting me to kind of just like dry there by myself. But at least it's something that was always incorporated into my life. And the PTSD, I think I had a pretty good understanding from since I was like two or three, because my father would always tell me, and he would kind of tell me in almost like as if he was telling a fairy tale, because he didn't want it to be something that was scary for me. It's funny because even during the times when it seemed like I was in danger, I never felt unsafe. And I felt like I knew what to do somehow. I think it's important for people to hear about it. I mean, it doesn't even have to be trauma related to the war. And obviously PTSD manifests itself in many different forms. But just to kind of show it's okay to talk about, you know, there's such a stigma around mental health.
Yeah. Lon, you write with such detail, this inherent connection between you and your daughter, especially as a baby, how you could actually see the disposition of your daughter change based on your presence and attention to her. Were you aware of how much your pain was affecting your daughter?
Yes, in fact, I could tell. Of course, I knew that this is not the conventional, quote-unquote, normal part of mother-daughter relationships. So even though I was in therapy in college, I didn't continue really through, it was not an enduring, uninterrupted relationship with therapy. But when I had her and I realized that, oh, this could affect her, that there could be something intergenerational, I did go into therapy. And so I restarted when she was three, when I started noticing that she may be seeing things and that, you know, I need to understand how to deal with this, not just how I've been dealing with it, which is sort of in a self-focused way, but seeing how it could affect the child's development and attachment.
Mm-hmm. You know, this book was really a way of reconciling this, as well as all of the work that you've done on yourself. But as a mom, have you found a sense of maybe forgiving yourself for that time?
I find motherhood very, very much like an enigma. And that's because I just never know exactly what the recipe is or what the rules are. And even without this issue, I think that it's just something that the parent and the child has to figure out as they go along, because it's a fluid, moving relationship. So yes, I think forgiveness, even knowing when to let go, which I think is very hard for a mother, knowing when to let the child be, knowing when to be supportive, knowing when to forgive yourself, and also ask for forgiveness. So it's a very mysterious relationship. That's why it reminds me a lot of immigration. It's like going into a new country every day.
What a way to put it. You know, I mean, you illustrate this in the book, the parallels, the experiences, the school experiences that you all had, for instance. There were similarities, but also differences. Lon, you realized when you were 13 in the United States that you, and this was going to be your home, that you needed to really be a part of the culture. You learned English, you excelled in school. But how challenging was that realization that this is the path that you needed to take?
It was literally like a shock when I saw Vietnam fell on TV. And I then decided I have to learn English. It has to be a normal part of my life. And I have to, quote, assimilate. But I also realized when I got into college that up until then, all of my assimilation was sort of towards the mainstream Americanness, which is the whiteness of America.
Harlan, when you hear your mother talk in this way, as someone who I guess would be considered a first gen American, born and raised here, what comes to mind for you when you think about this idea of assimilation?
Honestly, because the only real role model I have for that is my mother, I honestly think of the word success, and I know that might not be right, but she's so like high functioning, and it's very complicated because when I see those shadow selves, right, she's very small to me and like helpless and full of pain. But then on the other hand, I see her writing 4 articles at once, publishing stuff all the time, teaching and blending in and being, you know, like celebrated by people at work. And so I never really saw the struggling part, and I can't relate to it. So all I can go off of is what she's told me, the stories.
What was it like to write this book? I'll start with you, Lon.
Well, the writing was difficult because I think all collaboration can be very difficult. People have their own opinions. And collaborating with your own child, who is in her teenage years, when I think it's normal to be defiant and questioning and trying to pull away from the parent. And then acting as each other's editor. We had one instance where I wrote and then she would write. And then we would look at each other's work and it became too explosive. You know, it's like Rashomon, that we disagree with each other's perspective. And so there was so much fighting that we stopped doing that. And we basically wrote in separate rooms. And we didn't really respond to each other as a strategy. We just wrote what we wanted to write. And then towards the end, our editors would suggest, I think you need to at least touch on what Harlan said in this chapter, and even if it's not a direct response, address it somehow, even if obliquely. So that's what we did.
Harlan, how has this changed you?
Well, first of all, writing it was a very big privilege. But at the same time, you know, since I was a baby and I wanted to do something with books or movies and writing, you know, when you're a kid, you have this dream and an idea of what it is. And I love my mom so much, but to do like my first project with her, that leading to so many fights, my 15-year-old, 16-year-old self started to really resent the writing process. And that was a big challenge too, is thinking to myself, you know, I know that I'm writing this in the most up and down period of my life. And as I'm writing it, there's stuff going on externally in my life with like relationships or friendships, or even things in the family that we don't write about. And I didn't want what I write to be totally influenced by how emotional I was. And writing about each other was therapeutic for me. I think I knew most of the stuff that my mom wrote about herself, but she told me about a month ago that she discovered my problems and the magnitude of them through the writing. And through the writing process, fighting about the book definitely was difficult, but at least we were fighting with a purpose, you know, because 15, 16, 17, you're going to fight with your mom anyway. And at least for me, I had like this final thing to produce and say, well, at least we have this. And I am very happy about how it turned out. And I think my growth as a teenager, turning into a young woman, I hate that term, but that's what it is. At least it's shown, and I like that.
Lauren Cao and her daughter, Harlan Van Cao, are authors of the new book, Family in Six Tones. Thank you all so much for laying yourselves and your relationship bare for the benefit of us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
To read an excerpt of the book, go to hereandnow.org.
Two Stanford University professors have won this year's Nobel Prize in Economics. Paul Milgram and Robert Wilson helped explain the intricacies of auction markets, which govern the sale of everything from stocks and securities to fishing quotas. The Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences said today that the winners improved auction theory and invented new auction formats, benefiting sellers, buyers, and taxpayers around the world. One of the winners joins us now, Paul Milgram, professor of economics at Stanford University. Welcome and congratulations. How does it feel?
Oh, it feels great. It's especially nice to be able to win with my dissertation advisor and neighbor, Bob Wilson.
Your neighbor?
Worked with years ago.
Yep. Interesting. And your work is on auction theory. Do you find that people are surprised how big a role auctions play in our lives? As I mentioned, you know, they assign airplane takeoff times, radio broadcast frequencies, mining rights, all sorts of things.
Yeah, I think people don't understand exactly that. By auctions, we refer to almost any market mechanism where people make bids and offers that determine prices and resource allocations.
And the Academy cited your work on new auction formats for goods and services that are difficult to sell in a traditional way. Tell me more about that.
Well, for example, in recent years, in order to provide more radio spectrum for mobile broadband services, we had to arrange to purchase back some television broadcast rights and then move other broadcasters onto new channels and then reassemble the spectrum rights that were cleared into rights that could be useful for mobile broadband. So they're complicated transactions. And so putting that all together in a way that actually works required a complicated new auction mechanism.
Hmm. Your colleague, Robert Wilson, developed a theory called the winner's curse. Now, that's when bidders will lowball their offers in an auction because they're afraid of overpaying. And then you helped explain why different bidders value the same object differently. That's something called private values. Talk about that for a minute, because it sounds like this is as much about science as it is about human emotion.
Yeah, there is. Simply a fact of logic that if people make errors in valuations, then people with higher estimates of value bid more, that the winner will tend to be somebody who's overestimated value. So that's what the winner's curse is all about. But there can be a reason that the bidders have a higher value than anybody else. They could have a shortage of what, for example, radio spectrum or fishing rights, and then they don't have to worry about it as much. And so when they have a private value, that is a private reason why the thing they're bidding for is worth more to them than to others, then the winner's curse is not so fearsome.
Hmm. And here we are in the middle of a global economic crisis because of the pandemic. You're a newly minted Nobel winner. Does your work have anything to tell us about this sort of historical moment that we're in?
Well, I wish it had more to tell us about the historical moment. There are some important resource allocation problems to be dealt with, you know, with personal protective equipment. We're going to have to prioritize vaccines and so on. Prioritizing resources and using them in the best way is important. But, of course, even more important these days is actually discovering the vaccines and the treatments and taking care of people who are out of work.
Yeah. Economist Paul Milgram, who along with his Stanford University colleague Robert Wilson, won this year's Nobel Prize in Economics. Professor Milgram, thank you and congratulations.
Thank you very much.
And here's an idea for anyone who needs a break from the news in these difficult times. Go to your computer and search for Fat Grizzly Bears. The annual competition to crown the fattest bear of Katmai National Park in Alaska wrapped up last week. My daughter proudly voted for the winner, bear number 747, a portly beast whose belly practically drags on the ground after stuffing himself with salmon to prepare for a long winter. The wildlife cam organization Explore.org described the winner this way.
He's one of the more dominant bears on the river, estimated to weigh more than 1,400 pounds. He's really, truly one of the largest bears on Earth and the most massive bear that I've ever seen in person.
Alaska is home to some 30,000 lumbering grizzly bears, but the population is far less stable in the lower 48. Numbers have rebounded because of protections from the Endangered Species Act, but that also means grizzlies are more likely to run into people. Bryce Andrews knows about this well. In his 2019 book, Down from the Mountain, Bryce writes about the summer he spent working at the edge of grizzly habitat for a conservation group in Montana's Mission Valley, trying to keep bears out of a farmer's cornfield. We spoke in April of that year. The way you describe the Mission Valley is incredibly vivid, and I was hoping you could read a passage for me. Do you have the book with you?
I do, yes.
Great. I'd love it if you could read the section where you describe this place in August, and the bears are feeding on the fruit trees that are dangerously close to civilization.
The grizzlies knocked hot-fleshed fruit to the ground. They sucked hard at the teats of summer, eating until their guts succumbed. Apples ripened everywhere. Bitterroot Macintoshes on leggy, untended trees, prized honeycrisps in orchards, crabapples on the banks of creeks and sloughs, and the feast became frenzy. The grizzlies fed in a series of massive inhalations, taking food the way a skin diver breathes before ducking beneath the waves. This was the rule of August. During the day, the valley belonged to humans. Tractors worked the fields, and children played carefree in the yards. People swam in shady eddies and picnicked beside the creeks. Life, even at the edge of the woods, went on as if ravenous creatures were not hiding among the trees.
It feels a little ominous, that tension between the animals and human beings. How did people deal with that there?
Well, I think different people deal with it in different ways. Certainly the people who are raising some of these crops, like corn, that grizzlies have learned to feed on, the tension exists for them not just as a philosophical feeling, but as a daily reality where they're losing crops. They're having the thin margin of modern agriculture whittled away by these wild animals on the landscape. Other people are shockingly unaware. I mean, I did a series of events in the Mission Valley and in bear country, and there are people, you know, we can look at collar data and see that these bears are in someone's backyard. And then you talk to them and they say to you, I had no idea that grizzlies were in this area.
And your job one summer
is to keep the bears out of this farmer's cornfield by building a fence around it, an electric fence.
It's the kind of place where you really wouldn't expect to see a grizzly bear. But in this case, the cornfield provides, unfortunately, this almost irresistible source of late-season food for the bears.
They love it.
They love it, but it's very bad for them because at a time when they should be up in the peaks feeding on these big colonies of insects that actually nest in the high mission range, they're instead down on the valley floor eating this carbohydrate-rich, fairly unhealthy crop that puts them in conflict with people.
And the fence kind of worked, and it also kind of didn't, right? I mean, like, why didn't that fence, the shock of it, keep those bears out of the cornfield?
There are a lot of reasons for that, and I think probably the primary one has to do with the individuality and inventiveness of these animals. They were looking for every single way in or out of this cornfield because they were so used to having it for about a decade. So, for instance, an irrigation ditch would go dry one night. They would slip under in that muddy canal and get into the field just like that. I think the other part of it has to do with, as I mentioned before, the razor-thin margins of modern agriculture. So the corn farmer who was raising this crop, he doesn't have the time or the resources to commit to maintaining the fence, which makes it very hard to make it a perfect solution.
So over the course of the summer, you're building this fence. You also discover that someone in the area has shot one of these bears. Her name is Millie, and you become almost haunted by what happened to this animal. Can you explain how her fate became mixed up with the humans in the Mission Valley?
It boils down to the placement of this cornfield and the draw of the crop. So just above the cornfield in the foothills of the Mission Range is a place called Millie's Woods. It's the grove that this particular bear is named after. That grove is some of the densest occupied grizzly habitat in the lower 48. So it's a natural place for bears to congregate. And from that location, you can actually see into this cornfield. So it's a very natural progression to come to the edge of the foothills that way. And this cornfield was providing a perfect kind of a gateway drug to being comfortable around humans, which was eventually her unmaking.
And you knew she was injured because there were game cameras around this fence in the cornfield. But the fascinating thing about this book is that you didn't actually come across Millie or any bear, really, in this book until it was almost over. But I got the sense that you kind of wanted to.
Certainly. And I can't fully explain or entirely defend that because there were moments when I look back on them. These were the times when, like, my grandmother would hear about it and threaten to stop praying for me if I didn't cut it out. But there was this very real desire to be near them, to understand them, to have the bears on the landscape, to come close to them and to encounter them. It really changes the way you look at the world. I mean, for me, I felt that it sharpened my senses and it gave me a sense of perspective, of some kind of understanding of a time when we existed in a world that exceeded our species.
And what about the people living around this farm? Did they worry about the fact that these animals were there? Did they kind of do things to stop them from coming into their space?
I think that's a really good point to raise. There's a lot of low-hanging fruit for us to pick in the landscape in terms of improving the way we coexist with these animals. So if somebody's leaving out hides, if somebody's leaving out unsecured garbage, or they have chickens that are not behind an electric fence, we know that those things are going to lead to dead bears. So there are a lot of these very practical things that we have to do as we look at this extremely important moment in the recovery of the species.
Millie had two cubs that she abandoned after she was injured so badly. They survived, but that's only because they were captured, brought into captivity, and eventually sent to the Baltimore Zoo.
Correct.
Are those cubs better off in captivity for the rest of their life? Or would they be better off perishing like their mother did?
That's a very good question. I still don't know which would be better for the cubs, but I think I know what's better for us. I believe that to the extent that it's possible, any sort of emotional, individual, personal connection that we can forge between human beings in the modern world and animals like the grizzly is of vital importance. I know those cubs will not enjoy being in a zoo, but what I hope is that people will form meaningful relationships with them, which will cause them to care about the species.
But you do have a tough task in front of you. I want to play part of an interview that I did in 2016 with a Wyoming rancher near Yellowstone. His name was Nick Patrick, and he'd been mauled by a female grizzly while working on his land.
And so the first thing she did was reach up and bite me in the face, you know, and then it was just a melee from there. And she at one point grabbed me by my left knee and drug me about 20 feet and bit me through the hand. And then she finally decided she'd, I guess, taught me a lesson, and she took off.
Now, I play that, you know, not to be sensational, but because on the one hand, these are majestic animals who were living on this land long before we were. On the other, they do have this power to do a tremendous amount of damage. And it's your job to convince us, right, that both of these species can live together.
Yeah, I think it is my job to explore that relationship as deeply as I can and to look at it honestly, because I feel for him. I'm afraid of that outcome. I mean, that's a terror. I've had nightmares about it. At the same time, I want to highlight how infrequently that happens for the number of humans and bears that are on the landscape. And in the course of my encounter with bears, I felt a huge measure of fear. I've also felt extremely lucky and humbled. And I actually think that those three emotions are good things for human beings to be feeling, probably always, but certainly in our present moment.
Bryce Andrews, his new book is Down from the Mountain, The Life and Death of a Grizzly Bear. Bryce, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
I spoke with Bryce Andrews in April 2019.
As the pandemic drags on, environmentalists are wondering what effect it's had on our air and oceans. David Ford says worldwide, it's a mixed bag. Ford is founder of the environmental literacy organization Soul Buffalo and the Ocean Plastics Leadership Network, a group which brings activists and industry together to find solutions to ocean plastic pollution. Dave, welcome to Here and Now.
Hi, Tanya. Thanks so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
How bad has all of this gotten with COVID-19?
So it's interesting because there's been this environmental silver lining around COVID-19. Carbon reduction is like 4 to 5%. We've seen wildlife markets around the world get shuttered. Vietnam completely shut down their wildlife market. And then we're also looking at air quality improvement around the world. But with ocean plastic, things have just gotten significantly worse. There's 30% more waste coming into the system, all the different takeout. There's 129 billion face masks being made every month, enough that you could cover the entire country of Switzerland with face masks at the end of this year if trends continue. And a lot of these masks are ending up in the water. They look like jellyfish. Turtles and other wildlife are eating them, and there's just no sign of that slowing down. And most of these masks are made of nonwoven plastic.
We've discussed on this program how very little of the plastic we use is actually recycled, but how have recycling programs that we hear often about in the U.S. been affected by the pandemic?
Well, not just in the U.S., but all over the world, we're starting to see recycling programs start to shut down. Budgets are getting cut. Peoria, Illinois, is one of the early ones that we've heard has made significant cuts here. There was rumors that New Orleans was going to have huge recycling cuts. I think we're still waiting to see really what the fallout is. In the Southeast Asia, where so much of the waste is coming in, we're starting to see, you know, recycling programs shuttered, waste picking communities, you know, operating at 50% or actually shutting down. They are the last line of defense between plastic and the environment.
Last year, I spoke with Unilever Chief Research and Development Officer Richard Slater about the company's pledge to cut its use of non-recycled virgin plastics in half by 2025. And he drew on the industry argument that plastic packaging is lighter, which means less shipping and therefore fewer dangerous emissions that cause climate change. Let's listen.
If you simply take the simplistic view of trade-off with another material and replace all plastic with glass or metal, it's going to have adverse environmental impacts in other sources, so, you know, weight, transport, energy use, etc. So we have to take a balanced view.
Does this argument make sense to you, Dave?
It's really a paradox in itself, right? I mean, plastics are lightweight. They can result in dramatic fuel savings. That's certainly the industry narrative around all this. You know, and also like where we're at right now, I mean, your plastics are in the oceans, they're in the deepest parts in the Mariana Trench, they're on mountaintops. There's studies that it's raining plastic, it's inside of our body. So it's a super material that makes so much possible for our existence. Then on the other hand, it's also, you know, just absolutely everywhere, and we haven't been able to figure out how to control the way it gets into the environment.
Mm-hmm. You say transparency is one way to move forward toward a solution. What exactly do you mean by that? And what do you see? I mean, do you see any signs of us getting there?
You know, transparency is definitely, I think, one of the lowest hanging fruits. And we are starting to see some pretty interesting things that are happening from industry specifically. The World Wildlife Fund has this initiative called Resource Plastic, which is all about getting big companies to go transparent about how much plastic waste they're putting into the, you know, basically they're making, where it's ending up or where they think it's ending up. So just this past June, they put out their first report, and Keurig Dr. Pepper and McDonald's and Procter & Gamble and Starbucks and the Coca-Cola company went transparent about how much plastic waste they were producing, geographically, where it was all going, how much of it was recycled, how was from recycled content, how much from virgin content. And it's a huge step forward, because for us to figure out what we're going to do with it, we have to figure out how much is getting out there to begin with. So, you know, from our perspective, is extremely courageous as well for these five companies to really, you know, pull the curtain back on their operations, because it, you know, it opens them up, you know, to a lot of, you know, activist organizations. So there's this Transparency 2020 report that just came out from the World Wildlife Fund. It's pretty incredible. And their goal is to have 100 of the biggest companies in the world do the same thing by 2030. And, you know, we just would love to accelerate that even further. It's like, how can we get 1,000 companies by 2030? Because with respect to this issue, I don't think we still want to be talking about supply chain transparency 10 years from now. Like, we really need to accelerate across the board with how much of this is getting into the environment.
David Ford is the founder of Soul Buffalo and the Ocean Plastic Leadership Network. Thank you so much, Dave.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.
Tired of pandemic cooking? French chef Jacques Pepin says simplify. Use pre-washed greens, canned goods, frozen pastry. We'll get his tips for cooking during COVID next time, Here and Now.